to be lost if they have in the past. So I wrote it up in the American Psychological Journal subsequent to this. And people were talking about this radical new approach. Radical new approach that the cure for losing is winning. You take your hand, your life in your hands when you go to a medical professional with this kind of an attitude, especially in the psychiatric field. If you've ever been tempted to go into psychotherapy, avoid it if all possible. It is not the best road to curing of mental health. Best road for curing of mental health is to alter that which is causing the disturbance, turn the coin over, and to live a life that is the opposite of the negative life, which is a positive life. And that's all therapy is any good for, is to direct people into a path that, in which they will be able to live with comfort and ease, harmony, and most especially autonomy. Autonomy is a saying that I am the master of my destiny, to the degree that anyone can be the master of their destiny in an overcrowded society. And to say, I am myself, am heaven and hell, and I am myself make the way or refuse to take the path that will lead to happiness. Because so many of us get so much pleasure out of misery that the alternative is not very good. What would the hypochondriac do without his disease? Be well? Not very often. But the loser that I can comfort was not a person who was a compulsive loser who was getting a tremendous benefit out of losing. These people were under indictment. They would go to jail. They had lost their licenses and only had provisional driver's licenses to pursue their occupation if they went into some kind of therapy. It was naturally a kind of a game with them. They were not going into therapy because they wanted therapy. They were going into therapy to keep their license. So the first thing they said was, hey, doc, let's just get down to the subject of winning here. Let's not have any psychological crap, huh? I said, well, you already know everything. You already know everything. Yeah, because every one of them was really a winner. Not one of those people. And I worked in penitentiaries, and I found the same symptom. I never met a guilty convict. And I never met a loser who didn't lose because, hey, geez, he was coming down to the wire there and his stupid jockey stiffs him. Or the horse won a race, but the secretary, he don't like it when that jockey's on it because he was going to pay a higher price, so he misread the photos and put the other horse up. The jockey stiffed him. The trainer was doing a trick, playing a game. There was something. Yeah, but what if Ida, nobody ever lost. It was always some contrivance of fate. They picked him especially. Willie Shoemaker, who'd been writing since 1949, Willie Shoemaker selected one of these clients of mine personally to drive into a state of insanity, because every time this man would bet on Willie Shoemaker, Willie would purposely lose. Every time that Willie Shoemaker would win, he would deceive this man into not betting on him. And that's true. And he would run up and down that track screaming at Willie Shoemaker and telling him just exactly how he was conspiring just to make life miserable for this man. And if he got in a crowd of people watching the races, he would find other people who Willie Shoemaker had conspired against. And then every other jockey on the ground had his particular few that he was conspiring against. And when you get them all together, naturally racing is a conspiracy. These people were very conspiracy conscious. But they were no different than some of the biggest names in handicapping. We have people, highly lofted, elevated people who have written books who will tell you about the conspiracy at Aqueduct. You cannot possibly win at Aqueduct, Belmont, and Saratoga, incidentally, because all the horses have buzzers. It's impossible to win here. I don't know why you're here. I don't know how Michael and Dr. and Reverend May and all these people are winning. I think I know. Michael knows how they told him. They told Michael how. Michael was No, no, it has nothing to do with that. No, this is, he was innocent. Michael goes to the races with one of the foremost authorities in New York on trip handicap. In fact, he was the person who invented the contemporary concept of trip handicapping, was Andy Beyer's mentor, if you can believe Andy Beyer having a mentor. He stands next to Michael at the races, and he's saying, look at that. He's stiffening. He's buzzing. He's chick through the chicken. And Mike's sitting there, huh? And they said, and they threw down their tickets, and Mike's got the winner, and he says, yeah, but how come I won? The guy looks at him, because you're betting on the fixed horse. And it happens day in and day out. And contrary to what they may think of Michael, he has no idea of which horse is supposed to be fixed. And yet he consistently bets on him. So a lot of that, that's how Michael gets his reputation. The conspiracy theory is probably the most dominant one in horse racing. And when it is voiced by people who are given the status of experts, it becomes to me very disgusting. Because if anyone in this room truly believes that horse racing can be fixed beyond an infinitesimal few races in a given year, they don't belong handicapped. What kind of masochist would go and try to make a living at a game or the sport or an occupation that he thought was rigged against him? That's ludicrous. Nothing is, in this society of ours, which is suspect at best, nothing is less suspect, really, than horse racing. But all of my clients had the conspiracy theory. They lost only because it was rigged against them. So that was the first obstacle we had to overcome. And that's a tough one. Once we got over these barriers of knock off the psychological crap, once it got down to, hey, let's make a clinical contract, which is what all of you made, whether you intended to keep it or not, is secondary, but all of you are asked to make a clinical contract with me that you would devote yourselves to following the procedures of the methodology until you were doing at least 63% consistently, and then you were on your own. We'd continue to follow up, whatever you wanted, but you had accomplished the first obstacle. We made the same clinical contract with these people. Initially, we made it 45% with one horse, which was considered very good at that time. We later found out the phenomenon of the fact that you make more money betting two horses by the way we do it, 60-40, than you make with one, because when we would get to 45 or close to it, we would suddenly find the phenomenon of winning on the $6 horse but having that alleged second choice come in and pay $40 and $50 when we weren't on it, simply by clinging to the ancient myth that if you bet on more than one horse, you're betting against yourself. Jimmy Bradshaw found out where that axiom came from the hard way. We knew what it was. It was invented in the time of the 1920s, when bookies were rampant. Bookies, most of the superstitions were invented by bookies to keep people from winning. And one of the great bookie things was, hey, man, if you bet two horses, you're betting against yourself. The thing that every bookie in America fears more than anything is the man who bets two horses to win. Dutch Schultz put the fear of God in him. He's the guy who they named Dutching after, incidentally. But a bookie is deadly afraid of a man who bets two horses to win. In our little area in Southern California, we used to find two bookies, and one of us would play one horse with one with the other, and one with the second bookie. And we'd go along pretty well, because if you only play one with one fellow, he doesn't take too big a loss each one. But one day they stopped delivering the racing form to where these two bookies picked it up, and they both had to go to a second town over the hill, and caught my friend, who happened to be Daryl Martin, my first research director at the time, and myself together. I mean, you've been, and I've been, they treated us like we were criminals. Because we had the audacity to play two horses in a race and divide our earnings. And these persons were absolutely, well, they looked upon us as derelicts, as the most rotten type of human being playing a dirty trick like that. Bookies, if the bookie doesn't like it, you know darn well it's good. You try betting two horses in one book in Las Vegas and winning, And they catch you at it, they'll throw you out. We got some clients who are tellers. You got to go to one place and bet one horse and one other. When you get serious, when you're there long enough for them to spot you. Betting two horses, if they fear it that much, it's got to be good. So that's one of the secrets. That's the way you pick up the long shot. So after we solved some of these psychological problems, the idea was to come up with what wins horse races. Not wins what wins 5,871 instances taken a cross-section of statistics, as Dr. Quirin did, which are marvelous statistics, and I admire Dr. Quirin's work immeasurably, but what factors wins races consistently. We know, all of us know, that the reason there can be no rules in handicapping is that we are dealing with a set of variables in handicapping. We are dealing with no constants. There's only one constant, that the jockey must be on the horse's back when it crosses the wire or it can't be declared the winner. 100% of winners are ridden by jockeys. There's a heck of a statistic. Hey, bet on a horse with a jockey. Pretty ridiculous, but you know how many people make up their own statistics every day which are just as ridiculous as that? Subjective statistics are what make up most of your systems, and subjective statistics are what get people astray. APV doesn't work, Doc. I did a statistic on it last week. Three races. How many people change their statistics after each loss? I got a fellow who has five programs from us. Every time he loses a race, he goes to a different program. And if we got to use one of ours, he uses one of the other ones he bought. Doesn't matter. Then there's the guy who knows how to program. He's the most dangerous of all. Guys like Clisham. What could I do to change the program to make that loser a winner? So he goes in, he changes the algorithm. Oh, that got it. We have some programmers that they keep changing the program to get the winner after the fact of each race, and pretty soon they've lost the real program. They got this whole marvelous set of new values, but it is a set of variables. So in my innocence, remember, you think some of you don't know anything or didn't know anything, or Bradshaw didn't know anything. Listen, I went to a horse race once. With a bunch of guys from mental hospital to get a patient. You know the guys with the nets and everything? They didn't really have nets. That's the only time I'd ever been to a race course, was to pick up a patient of mine who had escaped from a mental hospital. We found him in a grandstand. Now all my patients are in the grandstand. I watched it. So I didn't know anything, but I knew this. I read they brought all these books and every book. And we had the Harry Smith, who has Smith's newsstand up there. You've got the turf bookstore in New York City, very similar. He has everything ever written. So everybody would bring us all these books and give us books, and we read everything. And I had a room, a blackboard about the size of that wall, and we wrote every one of the several hundred variables, which some experts said would win all the races. We had everything about trainers, everything about jockeys, everything about post positions, everything about class, drops, ups, double drops, switches to jockeys, post position, weight, early speed, which they call speed, stretch gainers, everything you've ever read. You name it, we had it on the board. Now, in the rules of statistics, the science of statistics, which I had to take because all of you know I'm deficient in math, in order to get into graduate school, because I had the math deficiency, I had to take graduate statistics because I couldn't figure 2 and 2 is, I got it, don't tell me. So I took that. Didn't do any good with my math, but I learned about statistics. And what you look for in statistics are corollaries that produce 68.6% of anything. You want to make up a statistic? 68.6, that's it. You can walk down the street and you can say that 68.6 of anything is normal. And you'd be accurate. You can say 68.6% of anything is something. And you'd be accurate. Because that's what they call a standard deviation point. On either side of that, the deviation begins, up and down. So the concept was to find some variable that in the top four of which is another statistical norm, you want to find the 1, 2, 3, 4 ranking in any order produces a desired result 68.6% of the time. Which one of these variables in its top four ranked horses, in other words, in our particular, would produce a winner 68.6% of the time? Not one single variable did it. When we got to we started getting into fractions, into we read Talbot, we read Huey Maul, we could have put them all aside and just read Huey Maul, we'd have saved 2 years. We started into fractional times. We tried to take the race. We listened to Julius Caesar. Remember Julius says all Gaul is divided into three parts, et Gallus dividio in tres partes. When he wanted to conquer Gaul or France, he decided a three-pronged thrust would be the only way to conquer this previously unconquered land. And that is precisely what a race is, a three-pronged thrust. It is the first fraction, the second fraction, and the third fraction. Speed handicappers use one element of pace, final time. That is like taking all of your armies and going straight. Like that's how the folks beat the redcoats in the Revolution. Because the redcoats and the conventional armies at those times marched in a single thrust. We take three thrusts at it. So we started with thrust one, the first fraction. It did not produce a winner in the top four 68.6% of the time. Ironically, the second fraction in the race produced it in the top five. Then came the second call. Now that was getting between four and five. The final fraction, apologies to Colonel Bradley, did not even get in the top five. The second call and the second fraction were getting closer than anything else. APV, that poor malign creature average purse value, the top five was producing 68.6% plus. This is a minimum standard. Lo and behold, we found that when we combined velocity figures, combined the first and second fraction into what we call early pace, we were under circumstances, specific circumstances and specific distances, getting very close to our corollary of four. Only when we combined early pace with sustained pace, which when we combine the second call with the third fraction to create sustained pace, when we combine that with early pace, at last we get 68.6% in the top four. That being a winning factor, our first positive corollary, we call it factor W. W merely is for winning. That was the beginning of a valid corollary as to what would win at the races. So we're doing all this by hand, and I mean we had things filling rooms and we had people making out charts, and I was picking pace lines because we needed only one person. It had to come from one set, one mental set, and at that time the rest of them didn't have a mental set. They were they would do sneaky things, picking the best line, the second best line, making up a line, averaging lines. I was the only one I could depend on. I wasn't even too sure about me. As we grew, I picked about 1,700 races in a few months there, and as we grew, we got some people who had enough equanimity to do it in a comparable manner so we could depend on the pace line selection, because that, after all, is the solution. The problem with the statistics, for instance, and I don't say there's a problem with them generically, the problem for us with the statistics of John Meyer or William Curran is that they took every horse in the race and applied exactly the same criterion. That will tell you the facts you want to know, but it will not get you the winners. You have to apply handicapping realities. And the only way you could do that was pick a pace line, at least from the same mental set. And then the problem was to teach other people pace line selection. We then got a computer. We rented a computer space at the University of California, Riverside's mainframe computer. And over the years, got 14,800 races, which is now up to 28,000, but our initial study was built on 14,000. This computer was able to take any variable or combination of variables and do anything you wanted to with them. Add them, subtract them, divide them, do anything, square root them, you name it. So when somebody came up with an idea, which many of you have, and you thought it was valid, rather than say, yeah, it looks pretty good to me, which most systems are built on, incidentally, we would feed the data to now 28,000 races. And if it gave us a positive reaction, then it was under consideration. A negative reaction, sorry. As the database built, and as the intellectual strength of the new breed of client came along contributing to it, naturally refinements were made into the viable variables. Velocity alone has become replaced by a velocity in concert with the percentile relationship of the horse to the pace of the race it ran against, which up the win percentage even more. To a point where now if you pick a representative pace line, remember there's no right pace line and no wrong pace line. There is a representative pace line, there is a predictive pace line. For those of you who say, I don't know if I did this right or wrong, forget it. There is no such thing as right or wrong. Those are moral judgments. There is only winning and losing. There is only accurate or inaccurate based on the reality. But proper pace line selection, a predictive pace line coupled with the proper amalgamation of variables and combination of the use of variables will produce a winner in the top two, 63% of the time without any further consideration. Without any further consideration. I'm talking about variant, I'm talking about everything. In most of the races in this prodigious manual we provided you, there's 168 pages. That's the longest thing we've ever done. Just for you. It just grew like Topsy. But in that manual, you'll find many, many winning races, and you'll find that 85% of them are there without any use of an adjustment of any kind. Those of you who get carried away, as my original group got carried away with, yeah, but let's put a little adjustment here, let's put a little on this, let's put him a little something here for class, and let's put a little something for it was a rainy day, or this or that. All this is man tempering what the horse really did. And unless man does that with absolute fidelity to reality, man is imposing himself on the animal who actually has to run the race. And you can go just as far awry doing that as you can do things to help yourself. So Bert has purposely, in most of his races, done it without any adjustment. And many of them that I did, totally without adjustment. In fact, I prefer to do it without any adjustment. Let the horses do it. The reason that that is effective, and the reason you'll find nothing in the yellow manual on making adjustments, the only thing you have is distance adjustments and occasional optional class adjustments, is that pace takes into consideration, when you use a CompuGraph, those daily variants especially. The horse that looks lousy to you on paper on the CompuGraph suddenly comes up with a one and changes the complexion of the race. So proper pace line selection and minimal human messing around or adjusting is a secret to consistent success, and 63% success can be maintained just doing what the yellow manual says. Which is why when a man says to me, hey, I'm making these variants, and it doesn't say anything about the variants. I say, well, it doesn't say anything about the variants because you should get 63% first without worrying about making adjustments. We had a lovely couple here who did real well making adjustments, and when they suddenly lost a few races, they went back to the basics and found out that they were imposing too much of their own human values onto the realities that were standing crystal clear before them. But there's no greater lesson and no greater teacher than losing to get you onto the path of winning. But
The thing that I hate is the fellow who starts winning 70% the first week. Because I know I'm going to hear from him down the line, oh, what's going wrong here? Best thing is to start off losing and then work up to winning. If it works the other way around, I know nobody's going to be unhappy, but you do have to suffer a loss before you will understand sometimes that human tampering is the biggest problem we have. We live in an era when a lot of people think that unless a human being has something to do with it, it can't be any good. We believe in manipulation. We believe the trainers are manipulating these things, jockeys are manipulating these things, therefore I'll manipulate them a little bit, and we'll add a little here and take a little away here, and that's one of the biggest things. That's why this manual has probably more in it about not adjusting than any of the previous manuals have had in them about adjusting. So as you get a few moments, read through some of this, and you'll see an amazing number of races that were won without any adjusting. At any rate, what we look for and what we found and what you now have are the viable variables. We don't tell you to look for trainer maneuvers. We have clients who are trainers, some of them very good trainers and well-known trainers. Those trainers tell us categorically that most of the so-called trainer maneuvers that they read about in American Turf Monthly or people talk about them making, they never heard of. They laugh. They don't make these 90% of the maneuvers that are attributed to trainers. Trainers laugh about this. Trainers try to keep the horse in the best possible shape, healthy, in an era when racing, year-round racing, takes a great toll on the physiology of the horse. Keep it in shape, point it into a competitive level in which it might do something, hopefully come in fourth, because that's what pays the bills, and maybe get a win or so. In the high-level stakes races, there may be some of this maneuvering, and most trainers do not have time to even consider the strategy that is attributed to them in long treatises by authors who otherwise should know better. The trainer is made to seem like a Napoleon looking at a war map and is doing all these things to hide the quality of the horse until such a time comes when he can make it go in for large amounts of money, the betting stables and all that stuff. 90% of it is hogwash. 85% of the jockeys feel very happy to be able to hold on and stay on the horse's back from the gate to the end of the race. Sure, there are some jockeys. They say you put jockey A or B on the horse, he's going to be 2 lengths better than any other jockey. That means instead of losing by 7 lengths, he loses by 5. Why don't we pay any attention to jockeys and trainers? Because the horse would not have the running line that predicts his win had he not been adequately trained and adequately ridden. We have never had a loser who was predicted to be a winner because he was badly trained or badly ridden per se. He might have got a bad ride that day, and the trainer may have been dead drunk the week before, but he was not considered a bad trainer or a bad jockey. That was not it. Okay, well, I wouldn't bet on this trainer with your money. He hasn't won in 30 races. And that's the race he won. Because this fellow had a prejudice against the trainer. If you could meet some trainers as people, and meet some jockeys as people, you would find an entirely different breed than you have been taught to. Wayne Lucas did us a marvelous favor. We have said from the beginning that the reason that so many psychologists get into horse racing is because horses are far more predictable than human beings. And actually, that's all a psychologist does, is try to predict the behavior of human beings. If you predict it right, you're known as a success. If you predict it wrong, you're a failure. You become a sociologist. Horses have a predictable behavior. You have a case history. No doctor had a better case history than the past performance line you got on each animal. All you have to do is diagnose that past performance line, you can pick a winner. 70% of the time. That's enough. Never mind this 80 stuff. God doesn't want you to win more than 70%. If there is such a thing as buzzering and manipulations and post-position bias and all these things, that's the 30% we lose. The fellow who cannot, who has to wonder why he lost a race and lets that dominate his thinking, I lost the race, why did I lose the race, is losing sight of the reality that you must deal in percentages. You must deal in 20 race cycles, and if you win 13, you're pretty good. If you win 14, you're doggone good. If you win 16 and 17, you're playing two or three races a day. If you win 13 out of 20 and your average mutual is $10 or something, you're playing in volume, you're making more money than you'll ever need from the races. Then it's only a matter of how much, what percentage of bankroll you play. The 30% you don't win can be explained by one of those things that you worry yourself about. Worry about what's winning and not about what may make you lose. That's the first secret of success. If there's no way that you could have predicted the outcome, somebody showed me something today where they're blowing hot air into the horse's lungs. It's marvelous. It's all right, it's helping the horse, but if that article, then that article is bound to be misquoted, because it says it can add 7.5 lengths to the horse's performance, but what it said at the end of the article was it will not make a horse any better, it will merely make a horse able to better live up to its own capabilities. It's a health measure. It is not a panacea for slow horses. You will not, no horse can be run, will run any faster than he can run. He will just run up to form. That, blowing the hot air or whatever it is better for us than for anybody else, because it will be a helpful aid in making horses run to form. And that's all we're looking for. We're looking for horses' personality traits. They're doing a personality profile, just as you would if you were in a health healing professional thing. You're doing a Rorschach test, you're doing a thematic apperception test, you're doing an IQ, you're doing all these kind of tests on a horse, and you don't have to sit the horse down. See, with people, you sit them down and you do therapy on people, they lie to you. They've never a patient told them, maybe they'll tell the medical doctor the truth, but they won't tell a psychiatric doctor the truth. That's a game. I'll show him. I'm normal, but I'm going to make him think I'm crazy. Or I'm crazy, but I'm going to make him think I'm normal. The whole relationship between therapist and client in psychiatry is one of, I'm going to lie and see what I can do. Because he thinks he's smart and I'll show him. But horses don't lie to you. Bert Main told his congregation once, he passed out a racing form to his congregation. Well, that's a true story. And he said, I want you to look at on each one of these horses, you'll see these 10 lines. That is their past performance. That shows what they did every step of the way in that particular moment of their life. And he said, how many of you could stand to have a past performance history on your life printed? I mean, he uses his old forms wisely here. That horse is telling you a marvelous story about himself. And throughout this man, you will see a story. What page does a form cycle start on, Richard? Whichever Richard, I don't care. It's right after Quigley's dissertation on the same subject. But if that's on page 10, it's 26? On page 26, and I'm not suggesting everybody go through this procedure with a graph machine and everything, but it's kind of fun to make one of your own for a while until you recognize it. Now, Quigley's a professional musician. It's Michael who's the magician. And he knows about meter and about rhythm. Horses have a metier and a rhythm. Win, lose, bad, good, bad, good. And it's a cyclic thing that is very, very helpful in helping you predict how they're going to run today. And that merely is a graphic demonstration of it. In your mind, after a while, and at first maybe on paper, you draw yourself a little graph like that, and you'll be surprised at how many losers you'll throw out. What we're going to do after the intermission and throughout tomorrow and Sunday is take you step by step through the processes of which will be the most optimal for winning races. Those of you who had a chance to go through your manual slightly will see that we've reduced it to really to 9 steps. The 10th step being all important is to utilize the 9 steps into a record-keeping device. It's truly only 9 steps. 9 very simplified steps. We've been asked over the years, why don't you give a step-by-step procedure? Okay, we've done it. It's always marvelous. If you only you do this, I could really be a big winner. Generally speaking, those who are not going to be big winners are not going to be big winners no matter what steps we go through. Most of the barriers to winning exist right here. Those of you who are winners who were not winners before know that better than any. Those of you who have yet to become consistent winners, get with some of those who are consistent winners, and any problems that you have, they have had and overcome. 90% of the problem lies in ourselves, not in our stars or not in our handicapping. Handicapping is merely a matter of predicting the future from one of the most well-defined synopses of the past there is in all society. Burton Main was not inaccurate when he said that if every human being would let a past performance chart of his own life be printed, we'd know a heck of a lot more. You can tell a lot about a race horse if you do that, by these 9 steps. And that's where we'll begin after the intermission. But before the intermission, we have a gentleman here, I assume, yes, here he is, who Bert is going to introduce, who will tell you about an opportunity to go to Saratoga without having to wait in line, be in grandstands, being pushed and shoved.
Through one of the fellows who's at the seminar, I had the opportunity to meet Bob Hughes, who is a recently retired state worker and a man with a passion for the Saratoga racetrack. He's enjoyed it over the years and is the kind of an individual who likes to share a little of his enjoyment. And he called me up after I'd already made a package of the $38 additional for the banquet and the bus and a copy of the racing form and the $5 clubhouse admission fee for all those of you that want to take the additional thing. Well, he came up with another offer, which involves, once we get there, the Paddock Pavilion, which is it's a large canopy, a big tent, really, as he says. But it is the one place you don't get rained on in Saratoga, which is a nice feature. But it would involve being in there, which is the $5 admission, because that you get to go anywhere you want on the track for that admission. $16 buffet. He'll explain it a lot more length. But it's also mutual windows, which is nice, because the Paddock Pavilion's limited to 290, is it? And there'll be probably 25,000-30,000 people on Monday, so you know, anywhere between 20,000 and 30,000 people. It's nice to have your own private betting windows. At any rate, that would be $20, and what we would do is, if you wish to do that, take 5 off of that 38 and give me 33 and give Bob 20. But that's not at all necessary. If you want to go on the bus, go on the bus, and we'll give you the $5, you know, or take your $5 and buy your own admission, or save a couple and get grandstand, you know, just walk in and use the cheaper seats. But it's sounded like a new wrinkle, and it might be very interesting. So I thought that we'd invite Bob here to fill you in on it, and I'm sure a lot of you will want to take advantage of this.
That's for the recorder. Anyway,
okay.
This is the real one for the room.
It's a pleasure to be here. I welcome all of you. My name is Bob Hughes. As Bert had said, I'm a 56-year-old racing groupie. I've been given 5 minutes to invite up to 50 of you to join us at the Saratoga Paddock Pavilion, where you can practice your skills in comfort and count your money in equal comfort. We will provide at the paddock a reserved table all afternoon in the paddock. They're adjacent to the horses. You'll see every horse as they parade out to the post. You can watch them be saddled. Hot and cold buffet from noon until 3 o'clock. Very accessible cashing windows. Copious TV monitors. Clubhouse admission. Your official track program. What's the hooker? I want to get 5 minutes to explain. $20. Bert's already explained that, okay? I'll be outside during the coffee break. I'd love to spend the next 3 days with you. However, I have a party of 150 at the track tomorrow in the St. Paddock Pavilion, 150 on Monday, and I look forward to seeing many of you and listening to your conversations. You've got some real intelligent leaders here, and I'd like to thank all of you, Dr. Sarton and Bert, for having this 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
The coffee is going to be, I think, in the up in the front of the hotel is that little garden area, and they have that outdoor restaurant. And I wasn't sure tonight whether we'd, you know, all day tomorrow it seemed like coffee would be a better idea. So in my planning, I confess to you, I don't drink coffee, okay? If it involved something with foam on the top, I'd have probably... I didn't think coffee would be important for this evening. So it's up in the front, the little cafe there that's in the garden area. And I need to have a number of how many people want the banquet, because that's critical, and they need to know first thing in the morning so they can plan for it. It's going to be seafood Newberg and sirloin steak and rice pilaf. Sunday night, excuse me. Did I say Monday?
I'm not clear just from having heard from you, Bob, what the two things are. The banquet
Sunday night. The banquet is Sunday night, and that's just pure fun. You don't have to wait over until Monday for it or anything else. The buffet is a part of that. That's at the track Monday. Okay, the bus ride is Monday morning up about 11 o'clock, so we'll be there in plenty of time. It's only 30 minutes up the way here. Somebody told Doc that... it was closer to 50, and he knew the area and all this stuff, and who is this crazy minister who said it was only 30 miles? I have a deal for you. I'll pay you $5 a mile for every mile over 30 if you'll pay me $5 a mile for every mile under 50, okay? It'll take you about... okay.
I didn't say that. That's my words. As I remember when I drove down, it was about 40 miles, I thought.
Nope.
I realize that now. And I admit my mistake.
Look, I can't even see what I bring out in people.
And it was, or did I said I could be mistaken. And I was. And I might have admit you made a mistake.
That's exactly the kind of open-mindedness that you need for success here.
I'm a Scotch vegetarian, as big as you are.
Aye, laddie. Well, see, a great sort of character that you have when you... At any rate, I need to have an accurate count for the banquet, and Bob needs an accurate count for the Paddock Pavilion, because that's the tickets kill. Okay, the banquet is the banquet's going to be something like 25 a person or 22 a person if you can just stay for the banquet. The package that I lined up was the bus ride, the banquet, a copy of the racing form, and admission to the track, and all that was to be $38. Okay. All of that is $38. If you choose to make use of Bob's offer, his is $20. Okay, and that's the Paddock Pavilion, a buffet, and admission to the track, and a program. Now, obviously, the two track admissions overlap. So that was what I was saying. Mine would no longer be $38, it'd be $33, and then pay him the $20. And if you, you know, choose to do something else, you've got to either be $33 or 38 or 20 or whatever, but you can just take the bus up and, you know, not worry about what Bob's offer or combine the two. But it's this is more complicated, you have to know, than the methodology itself. I mean, and it's all due to Michael. He's making it complicated. I'll explain it to you.
The bus is on Monday. That's the
right. Banquet is Sunday night. Bus is on Monday. Okay.
What time is it?
What time? The banquet?
Yeah.
Banquet's 7. Yep, 7 on Sunday night.
Aren't you required to wear a coat in the clubhouse?
Not in the Paddock Pavilion. In the clubhouse, yeah. If you, you know, you'll have the admission that you can get into the clubhouse, and that would be, there is the dress code.
You don't need a jacket in the clubhouse either.
Oh, you don't need a jacket in the clubhouse?
Unless you have to take it.
Okay.
Only if you're going to go to the
open trip. Okay. One of the things that I've taken a lot of good about is that... I'm going to be giving up my maiden on Monday. I've never been to a racetrack. I've been waiting. I've been to the harness track 4 times, but because of OTB in this state, it's not necessary to actually physically be present at the racetrack. And so I have this little phone account, and I have never been to a thoroughbred racetrack. And they, you know, they kid you about things. Well, you've been to the harness track 4 times. Thoroughbreds are the sport of kings. Harness racing is the sport of farmers. So come on. And Cobleskill Fair, which is in Schoharie County, just west of here, had their harness races Tuesday, and I watched those. They don't have fair mutual wagering, which is probably a good thing. That I could enter my goats in, the harness racing there. But anyway, don't let Michael confuse you and complicate things. It's very easy. Dinner on Sunday. Yeah.
What is Sunday afternoon? What's
free time. After post time, after about 1:30 or so, if there are more questions, you know, we'll be willing to stick around. It's not going to be somebody who's not going to, you know, we won't have armed guards at 1:30 or anything, forcing everyone from your seats. But a lot of people will want to go to the track. There are a number of people here with cars, and so, you know, you can make arrangements, and by then you'll know each other pretty well. A lot of us aren't going to be going up to the track on Sunday. But it's just basically free time until the banquet. But that gives you plenty of time. That's why we scheduled it for 7, was so you could go up if you wanted to and get back in plenty of time to have a banquet. But there will be an open, the room will be open. We have a cash bar, and the room will be open prior to the banquet. So it's, you know. The banquet itself is 7, but the room will be open for at least an hour before that, for just gathering, and there'll be hors d'oeuvres.